This is Danielle Lucy Scott, Associate Editor of the Grazadio Business Report. Today we are speaking with Faresi Hogan-Rolls, President and CEO of the Community Financial Resource Center, the first public-private partnership, nonprofit economic development corporation. Ms. Hogan-Rolls is the former founder and executive director of Westview Economic Development Strategies, a Los Angeles-based training, organizational development, and consulting organization. Ms. Hogan-Rolls serves on a number of boards, including the Grazadio Board of Visitors, the Department of Water and Power Board of Commissioners, and the Federal Home Loan Bank Board of Advisors. In July 2007, she was named by California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger as a member of the California Commission for Economic Development. So thank you for being with us today, Faresi. Can you start out by telling us a bit about the Community Financial Resource Center, the CFRC? The center is dedicated to helping low-income individuals becoming homeowners. But what kinds of services and economic tools do you provide exactly?
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the invitation, and thank you so much. Community Financial Resource Center is, we help people start and expand businesses. We are about wealth creation in low-income communities throughout Los Angeles County. And so in order to achieve wealth creation, there are a number of ways to do that. One of the greatest, obviously, is homeownership, to become a homeowner. So we help people with first-time home buying workshops and seminars. We help people understand what mortgages look like, and we actually connect them to banks so that they can get a mortgage for their first home. So that's really important. It's one major aspect of our work. Our core business is small business development lending into low-income communities through business development. So we make small business loans. We offer several different types of loans, one patterned after the Grameen Bank model called Capital Partners. It's a micro-enterprise program. The loans start at $500. And people say, what can you do with $500? Well, you know, you literally can do a marketing campaign. You can purchase a computer nowadays. You can decide to buy a piece of equipment for your existing business. There are a number of things you can do with that. You can get your licensing accomplished in a lot of cases. For some people, you know, they may want to get into a multi-level sales business like Avon or Herbalife, and they can buy that initial startup kit. So there's a number of things. And we also have what we call a seed loan program, and you can get from $5,000 to $25,000, and you have to have been in business for 1 year, and then you can also get into the expansion loan program, which is up to $250,000. So those are some of the economic tools that we use to help people get going on their businesses, as well as we have what we call BizTech, Business Innovation Technology Center, where you can come in and learn how to automate your business, create a website, and also figure out how to do e-commerce at CFRC. So those are some of the tools we offer.
So walk us through the average client who comes into the CFRC for help. What do they leave with that they didn't come in with?
Well, you know, most people learn about CFRC through word of mouth and, you know, information like this, you know, interviews or people who've been to our site and got something that they needed. So you come to the door, and most people have been sent because their friend's cousin's friend told them to come over because they could get a loan. And so they come, first of all, expecting we're probably not going to give them a loan, but maybe in some obscure way we might deliver that. And I think they walk away with, wow, they actually gave us a loan. And you come in, and maybe you don't have a business plan. Maybe you don't have the skill set that you need to really make your business go like you'd want it to. You can actually come to CFRC and develop those skills. So not only will you walk away with a loan at the end of that process, and it doesn't take long. It's 6 to 8 week process, you know, and we don't run a credit check on the first level of business lending. In the microloan program, it's based on integrity, your commitment to the program, you coming up with your business plan, which we help you with, you can coming up with the way you're going to pay us back. And we help you build your credit if you haven't had good credit. So we help you build. So you're walking away with not only now sort of your own briefcase mm-hmm. set of tools through, you know, our workshops, which include how to price, how to market, how to manage, how to work with other businesses, how to collaborate, how to, you know, maybe purchase en masse with other business owners. But you also walk out with you're going to build your credit back up. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to figure out how to network a little better. So you're going to walk away with some skills that, you know, you may not have learned on your own, or you may have learned them on your own, but it took you 12 years instead of, you know, 6 weeks at CFRC.
It's very interesting. I know the CFRC has been around for over 10 years, mm-hmm. and you have some impressive facts and figures attached to that. Yep. So I was wondering if you could tell me some of the CFRC's accomplishments.
Well, actually, this year we're celebrating our 15th year. So we're very excited about that. We kicked off our 15th year celebration in March. We were opened in March of 93 for service delivery. And in that time, we've actually delivered services to over 100,000 people. We've put about 6.6 million on the streets in low-income communities with the average loan size of $70,000 in our major portfolio and our average loan size of $1,000 in the microloan portfolio. So we're really honestly reaching the target audience that we had planned to reach. In addition, we've helped 1,410 people purchase their first home since 1999. We actually kicked off our homeownership program in 2000. And since then, 1,410 new homeowners in low-income communities, no foreclosures. So that's my big statistic in mm-hmm. this environment where we're hearing, you know, right. 200 or 300 homes uh-huh. going into foreclosure, you know, mm-hmm. a month in California. Mm-hmm. And our story is, you know, we're not a part of that statistic. So on the one hand, it's really great. On the other hand, a lot of the contributions that would normally come to a nonprofit like ours are sort of being siphoned off for foreclosure support. But so we're having to battle mm-hmm. that little incident. But, you know, in all honesty, we help people get into homes. We create wealth, and that's the best way to do it. And we help people create jobs mm-hmm. through small business home ownership.
Well, actually, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you was about the housing slowdown in Southern California and how that has affected first of all, the advice that you give to your customers and your business model in general. Mm-hmm. You know, do you have individuals coming in for help, for example, mm-hmm. who have had trouble and have been affected by these subprime loans?
Well, you know, I have really been pleased, if you will, with our performance at CFRC, but willing to help because that's what we do. We help people that are challenged, and certainly in these economic times, it's been extremely difficult for a variety of homeowners who did get that got stuck with subprime loans that, mm-hmm. you know, reset and the interest reset and so forth. One, I feel like a feather in our cap is that about 3 years ago, and I had to get the statistic, and as you know, I sit on the Federal Home Loan Bank Board of Advisors, and so we had a meeting in April, and, you know, I wanted to share what our situation was, and that's how we found out we didn't have any foreclosures in our portfolio and that, you know, our borrowers and customers had actually fared very well in that way. And my staff, we dug back a little bit and said, why didn't we have that hit so hard in our portfolio? And what we did was we dug back, and about 3 years ago, when a number of our customers were coming in and asking for the subprime loans, or is there a way you can get us 110% financing and all of those, we steered people away from them. We actually mm-hmm. beefed up the foreclosure section in our home ownership counseling course and really spent triple the amount of time on why you don't want a subprime loan and what they do. And I think that helped to mitigate that risk that we would have had in our portfolio. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we are joining a coalition of nonprofit organizations that are assisting very specifically in foreclosure prevention and managing foreclosure crises. So although we didn't necessarily have it, we do see the need to do that. We have the expertise on staff. Our staff is now being cross-trained so that we can become a full part of the coalition to help people at this point in time. I think one of the most important things is that if there are people that know folks that are suffering a foreclosure, is to get help right away and call. If you can't call the bank or don't feel like you're getting anywhere, feel free to call our office, and, you know, we can certainly provide that help. I feel like I'm going to take a plug here and say 323-233-1900, and we can always, if we can't help you, we can get you to the right person.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people who are very happy that you made that plug.
Yeah.
moving on to more about the CFRC, it is said to be the first public-private partnership nonprofit economic development corporation. What private sector groups do you work with, and what exactly do these partnerships involve?
Well, you know, we were founded by the banking community in partnership with the City of Los Angeles. And at the time, Mayor Tom Bradley was the leader. And there was a study that came out of the Urban Land Institute about unmet credit needs in South Los Angeles and the existing low-income communities throughout Los Angeles County, but very specifically how bad it was in South Central, because at the time, over 80% of the banking branches that had existed in South L.A. Were gone from 1979 to 1989. They closed. And so there were all these people that were going, what happened to my bank? It used to be on the corner. It's gone now. So that was how CFRC came about. It was the first coming together of the banks, the community, and the City of Los Angeles to come up with a way to meet these unmet credit needs. And so that's why we were designed to be a source for delivering loans, both in the small business sector and in the housing sector. We were designed to provide technical assistance to people. So if they wanted to figure out how to move their lives forward, then we would be able to deliver that service. So that's how we were started, and it has maintained. We work with the banks largely. We work with corporations because we help banks meet their Community Reinvestment Act requirements. So they have a little bit of a nudge as to why they help us. People often ask me, if there wasn't a CRA, do you think they'd be involved? And for the most part, I'd say probably not. Mm-hmm. The CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act, really does press on the banking community to make investments into low-income communities. And because banks are committed to their shareholders, just like any other corporation would be, you know, you don't get the biggest return in terms of dollars, mm-hmm. but you do get your return not only in socially, but you also get your money back. You know, mm-hmm. you may not get the 15 or 17% return, but you're certainly getting a positive return. So that's who we largely work with. We're looking now to expand that reach because good, sound business practices make a difference whether you're a bank or an insurance company, or a financial services company, or a food company. Because if people don't have jobs, mm-hmm. then they can't buy the food, and they can't pay for their home, and they can't send their kids to school. So mm-hmm. What we're looking at now is how we broaden our message so that more people connect and want to invest with us to help then serve the low-income populations in Los Angeles, which would in turn create a better economy overall.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine that's a challenge. With the banks, you have the Community Reinvestment Act. Mm-hmm. With the corporations, not so much. So
not at all.
What are the challenges that you face in getting them to listen to you and getting them to help invest in the communities?
Well, you know, it's sort of a disconnect that I find. You know, one recent sort of turn of events, recent as in like 15 years ago, I guess, the insurance world was up against some legislation that might have caused a Community Reinvestment Act type legislation for insurance companies here in the state of California. And so we were all for it. And I say we, the community development leaders, were all for it because we were like, all right, you know, we can get the insurance companies to commit. Well, mm-hmm. there was a compromise. And it was that the insurance Office of the Insurance Commissioner came up with a program that was a compromise called COIN, California Organized Insurance Network. And it's a way that an insurance company or any corporation in California can actually invest in a community development financial institution, which is a designation that our organization has earned. CFRC is a CDFI. I don't want to get too many acronyms because people are going, what? Community Financial Resource Center is a certified community development financial institution certified by the Department of the Treasury in Washington. Okay, so there's also a way to become a California CDFI. And if you're a California CDFI, then any corporation can invest any amount over $50,000 into your organization for a five-year period, 0% interest to the nonprofit. So it really helps the nonprofit, mm-hmm. and 20% tax credit to the corporation. So it's fabulous. Well, the banks get that. So if you look at who's accessed these tax credits over the past 15 years, it's largely been banks. Even though it was designed as a compromise for the insurance industry, they largely haven't tapped into it. So for me, it's like this huge disconnect. So when we're trying to get people in the insurance industry and the entertainment business to connect with our message, it seems as sort of a disconnect. Why do I care about if low-income people in East L.A. or Pacoima or South L.A. have jobs? Well, you care because when people have jobs, crime goes down. Mm-hmm. You know, when people have jobs, they can boost the economy, too, because now they can buy goods and services. It takes the pressure off of the entire economic system because now you don't have so many people accessing, you know, food stamps and Section 8 and, you know, all these different sort of patchwork of services for people that can't make ends meet because now they're able to do that. So it mm-hmm. actually spurs the entire community of business and residential neighborhoods. So, you know, I think as an organization, we really have to broaden our message so that people start to connect there. But that's been the real challenge in mm-hmm. trying to get organizations or corporations outside of the banking world who were sort of forced to get it mm-hmm. To actually see how this connects to what they do.
You're obviously extremely passionate about serving the community, and you've dedicated your professional life to the service of the underserved. Mm-hmm. Currently as CEO and president of CFRC, previously as executive director for the Westview Economic Development Corporation and the Coalition for Women's Economic Development. But why are you so motivated to help others?
Well, you know, I sort of think about it's probably just ingrained in me. You know, I believe we're blessed to be a blessing. And, you know, my family is – I have a long history of people helping people. And so I see – it's like a vision or my passion. It's like my vision is to see everybody thriving and able to buy things and not homeless people on the corner and not people that are struggling, but instead – a holistic society that actually allows people to thrive and go to school and get an education and not get shot walking down the street and not have somebody rob your store because they didn't have any money or didn't have food. So when I'm looking at why am I doing this, it really is because I just really want to see a better world. I want to see the neighborhoods that I live in and drive through and have to connect with on a daily basis are healthy and safe. And people aren't unnecessarily being chastised because they don't have the economic wherewithal to make their lives move forward. So, you know, I just really believe we're blessed to be a blessing. And I've certainly been blessed through my life. And that's because other people blessed us. Mm-hmm. And I just think we should pass it on.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, your inspiration comes from a personal place. Mm-hmm. I've heard you say that you want to help revive your old neighborhood in South Central. I mean, you've seen over the years mm-hmm. the decline of that neighborhood and other such neighborhoods. And so talk to me a little bit about how the area has changed since you were there and what exactly are you trying to accomplish?
Well, sure. You know, I grew up in South L.A., you know, on 118th Street and Broadway. And I tell you, you know, I was a child. I was very, very, very young, I must say, when the first riots hit, you know, mm-hmm. and people will call it their rebellion or unrest or whatever. Anyway, we were playing outside. And all of a sudden, the fire went up, and we were, you know, my mom made us come in the house, and she was trying to explain to us why we couldn't go outside because people were randomly shooting, and there was a lot of robbing of stores and, you know, people getting food and all the kinds of things. And she said to us, you know, if people were all being treated fairly, this probably wouldn't be happening. And she said, you know, that's why you got to get an education so you can go help. So I think that started early on. After that, our neighborhood went kaputso. I mean, it just really spiraled down. A lot of the riot damage that happened in 1965, I could drive you through my neighborhood and it's still never been repaired. It's never been rebuilt. You know, you just don't typically, and that's true of a lot of inner cities around the country. In fact, most of them that had riots and such that were in the 60s and then later through the 80s and 90s, that has remained true. So when I was a child, I could walk to school. Oh, we walked to school. We didn't have these wrought iron bars on the windows. You know, everybody's lawn was manicured. You know, you didn't have pit bulls running up and down the street, so you were afraid to walk. And now, you know, that's not true. And we didn't have drive-by shootings. People didn't have access to guns like they have now. And certainly there were jobs in the community. I mean, everybody, that had a site that was, you know, zoned for business, there was a business in it. So people had jobs. I mean, people that lived next door to us, they walked down the street to work, you know. Mm-hmm. So all of that changed, I think, after the first unrest that happened, economic rebellion, riot in 65. And I think all of us were holding out hope for that to change. And here we are over 40 years later. Of course, in 92, we had another economic rebellion, if you will. And not only did the riot damage from the first time in 65, was it not unrepaired, but now most of the rest of it's not. I mean, some has happened, but not really. And so, you know, I'm still trying to figure out how it is that we can come 40 years and not have the economic improvements happen in these communities that needs to happen right now. In South L.A., the joblessness rate is 7 times higher in South L.A. than it is in the rest of the city. Why? Because about 350 businesses that were burned in 1992 have not been replaced. So when you don't have the businesses going back in, now you've got the population expanding, but they don't have anywhere to go for jobs in that community. So what do? Either they're unemployed or they have to go way outside the community to get a job. Well, you know, our public transportation mm-hmm. in L.A. is not so great, you know. So it just, you know, one problem leads to another. So I think, you know, as I look at this thing, I really want to see South L.A. and East L.A. and Pacoima and Wilmington, Harbor City. You know, I want to see all of these communities become the economic, sustainable, healthy environments that they really deserve to be. And I think if all of us work at it, then we can. So that's my commitment. Hey, we're the city of angels. We need to start acting like it.
Well, you said that one of the ways that you help small businesses is through your BizTech program. Mm-hmm. Am I saying that right? Mm-hmm. And that helps them create websites, develop e-commerce sites. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, you began working with the CFRC in 1995, which is just about when the internet was starting to pick up speed. And how do you leverage technology to help CFRC in achieving its goals? For example, your online presence, has it expanded awareness of what you do? Do you use it to reach out to donors and potential customers?
Mm-hmm. We do, actually. When I came to CFRC, it's so funny because I was in, I was actually in graduate school here at Pepperdine when I first went. And one of the reasons I took the job and left my consulting work was because I needed to be in one place more than 5 or 6 days. And in my consulting work, I was literally traveling all over the country. And, of course, at that time, we didn't have, you know, we didn't have the internet access that we do now. We certainly didn't have cell phones for the masses to have. I didn't have one. And I remember being in an airport and having a conference call with my group on a payphone in the airport in Chicago. So, you know, just shows you how things have come along, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I went to CFRC, I believe we had 3 computers. And they were those 460s or whatever they were, you know, with the floppy disk and all that, you know, and no internet access at all. And about 2 years into it, I recognized that the information highway was just streaking right by our low-income community, you know. And I went on a sort of a campaign to get, and that's where we came up with Business Innovation Technology Center. We said, we've got to use this. We've got to get people plugged in. And we came an official community access site to do online banking. We have since now, we have computers where people can learn the Microsoft Office suite. We have a website, of course, www.cfrc.net. And you can go there and learn all about jobs that we have. We actually have a regular, we used to do hard print on our newsletter. And now we send it out via email. And we send it to over 4,000
people. A lot more cost effective.
Oh, my gosh. A lot more cost effective. We can do it frequently now. We do it every month. And if we have a quick alert where we want to get some information to our customer base, we can do it within, you know, a 24-hour period. And you can go online and get any kind of form that you need from us. We haven't used it so much for our donors, but we're looking at that now. And we actually have started a plan around developing an individual and corporate donor campaign using the internet. So I think one of the presidential candidates has taught us all a lot about getting donations around the world with a minimal effort and what the internet usage really can be. So
right, $1,000,000 donations can go a long way. Speaking of the upcoming president election, how do you think it might impact opportunities for small businesses, particularly in the LA area?
People think that whoever's in the White House doesn't matter, but you know, it really does. I've been through several administrations, and as it relates to the work that we do, the Community Development Financial Institutions programming was actually designed and implemented during 1994. And it was a Democratic administration, and so there was money put behind it, and the good news is we figured out how to work on both sides of the aisle. So we've managed to maintain the integrity of the program because that program rests at the U.S. Department of the Treasury. But through the Republican administration, we've really had to fight to keep it funded. You know, I mean, it's been a real battle. So what does that mean to Los Angeles? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we don't have the funding at the federal level to come into the program at the local level, then our services are going to diminish, and then we're not going to be able to serve as many people as it relates to those contracts. So that's how it really plays out, and it really does make a difference. The community development block grant money, as those dollars have been cut, that's one of the reasons why the city of Los Angeles pulled back on its nonprofit community development contracts. Last year, they didn't even have an option for us to go and apply for a contract. So we don't have a community-based contract through the city of L.A. right now. So they really do impact you at the grassroots level.
Since you've done so much public sector work, I mean, we've just mentioned a few of the boards on which you participate, the Grazadio Board of Visitors, for one, the Department of Water and Power, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board of Advisors, and on and on and on. But how did you get involved with such a large range of groups, and what does your role consist of?
Well, you know, I often wonder myself. You know, I read that question, and I kept going, well, how did I get here? And, you know, honestly, I think that people are often looking for other people to either help them work on their vision and or expand their vision or help bring new energy to a vision. And I think the networking over my lifetime, really. I mean, I don't network and meet people because I'm looking for something. I don't meet a stranger.
Well, they're looking for you now.
I hope in a good way, right? But, you know, I think what's happened is people realize that I will speak up. You know, if I see something going awry or wrong, I will speak up. Or if I think it's wrong, I will speak up. And I think that people are looking for those of us that are willing to do that, take a stand for the greater good, if you will. And I don't mean to sound lofty about this, but, you know, willing to say something that will make a difference and then back it up. You know, if you say you're going to take a stand for, you know, this issue, then, you know, you got to be willing to stand. You know, you're not going to fold just because so-and-so walked by. I mean, I always remember my mother who said, you know, you don't scare. You are my daughter. And, you know, these people put on their pants one leg at a time. And so do you. So never think less of yourself. Well, you know, I'm in rooms now where I'm with people that are pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there going, well, he only puts on his pants one leg at a time. And my mom used to say this, he's no better than me. So I'm thinking, he's no better than me to me. I'm going to say it, you know. So I think a lot of it does come from my willingness to say what needs to be said, to stand up for what needs to be stood up for, and a willingness to back it up. And I think as I've met more and more people, they recommend me to so-and-so. And, I mean, none of these positions did I go and seek. Not one. Each one of them was a phone call to me saying, so-and-so recommended you, and we want to know if you're willing to do this. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I believe that's God, you know, just blessing me.
And your mother.
And my mother, right, watching out for me, and my dad watching out for me. But and my dad laying a path, you know, and I think this is very interesting because my father was 43 years a Department of Water and Power employee. And now I serve on the commission where my father was employed and was able to pay for all of us to go to school and, you know, have a, you know, go into a middle income family and be productive, because my father did have a great job, you know, and my mom did have, she was a stay at home mom until my brother got to be like in sixth grade. And then she went into real estate because she wanted to help people own homes. And, you know, so I think they paved the way for me to do a lot of this. And it's
in a very direct way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, it's like when I look at that, I go, wow. You know, I found some pictures when I was cleaning out a box of my father's. And I found some pictures of all of us in front of the commission crest in like 89 or 90, when my father was awarded his 40-year pin. And so now I am literally a commissioner in that same room, you know, and I make decisions for, you know, the world's largest public utility, public sector utility under that same crest. So certainly they paved the way. And then I help people get home, buy homes and such. So it is very true. I'm doing what probably was ingrained in me.
And getting back to your mother, I heard an interesting story when you had to choose between getting your MBA and getting a new car. And your mother had some choice words for you on what to do. Can you tell us that story?
Well, I was feeling pretty good about myself at the time. And that's funny you mentioned that. So my mother was very big on education, and I was very big on new cars. And, you know, I had done, I thought, enough education, because at that point I had two degrees. I had a, you know, associate arts degree in design, and I had finished my bachelor's at Loyola. And, you know, I was like, oh, and I got a new job. And I got a nice increase in my new position. Then I thought, ah, I finally have enough money for this BMW I want. So, you know, I guess I knew that it was a bad idea to just go buy this car. So I went to my mom's house, because at the time I was married, you know. And I went to my mother's house and to get her advice. And I said, Mom, you know, I'm debating. You know, I really want to go for an MBA, but an MBA is going to cost me like about $60,000. Of course, at that time I was working for a nonprofit, and, you know, that didn't get tuition reimbursement. In fact, I think I was the only one in my graduating class that did not have tuition reimbursement. I think I was the only nonprofit person. But anyway, so she looks at me and she says, have you lost your mind? Have I not taught you better than that? If you drive that car off the lot, it's not going to be worth a cent, but your education is going to be with you forever. What are you going to do? And I said, go to school for the MBA. That's what I'm going to do. She said, okay. So I never looked back. You know, I still haven't had that BMW yet, but it's coming, right? But had a lot more good success because of the MBA.
Your mother seems to have given you tons of really helpful advice in your career. Is there anything else that she shared with you that you'd like to depart to the rest of the world?
Oh, well, you know, she was just full of a lot of wisdom and was very committed to helping people. And, you know, she would say things like about voting. You know, I never missed an I missed one election, and I felt so bad. Like, I was like guilt ridden for like, you know, 10 years or something. I don't know, because the year that Tom Bradley ran for governor, he lost by one vote per precinct in the state of California. And I had forgotten to do my full confession now. I had forgotten to do my absentee ballot, and I was in New York. And, you know, they didn't have all the technology because this was 1982. And I just literally didn't get to vote. It's the only election I've ever missed. And I tell you, I felt so bad because he lost by one vote per precinct. So I thought it was my fault, you know, and it was, because I missed my precinct vote. Right. But she would say one vote, one man. Right. One vote, one woman. All you have is your vote, and that's your integrity. So if you don't use that, you can't complain about what's going on down the street, or you can't complain about the environment. So you need to make sure you vote. I mean, that was her big thing, you know. And then she would say, you know, you got to help others so that, because that you've been helped, so you got to help everybody else. Help as much as you can, you know. Or she would say, she was big on songs, you know, and so she would, you know, quote some Nat King Cole songs, or, you know, so she would come up with things, and you'd walk around singing these songs, but they were things to help you, you know.
And they'd stick.
Yeah, and they would stick, you know. And so she was just very, I think, very vibrant, very full of really love for her fellow man. And that's the way she was raised. And she was big about don't count your chickens before they hatch, you know, make hay while the sun shines. And a lot of things she would say I didn't get. now I get it. You know, now I understand what she meant, you know, about, you know, don't count your chickens before they hatch, you know, and all those. I'm sure everybody else's parents said the same things. But, yeah, she was she was a lot of fun.
Well, I'm wondering if you get your energy from her because, you know, with your full-time job as president and CEO, your board work, and your teaching responsibilities, I mean, what is your time management secret?
I don't know. You know, never let them see you sweat. You know, I don't have any time management secrets. I think, my rule, I come up with these little rules for myself, and my rule is make sure you take care of yourself. So that includes eating right and making sure you get some exercise no matter what. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the most beautiful things this morning was I was able to walk around the campus and look at the ocean and admire the waves. So I understood why we're called the waves at Pepperdine now. And, you know, honestly, prioritizing so that I make sure that I'm doing what I need to do. Because people will put demands on your time that they think are important. And if you do that, which I've allowed myself to get there, you are run ragged and you haven't done anything on your list, but you've accomplished everybody else's goals. And that doesn't bode well for what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So what I've come to realize is, and in this age where you have email and you have more than one email address and you've got, you know, three or four phone numbers, you know, and you've got extensions and, you know, you got fax machines still. And I'm going, wait a minute, you know, so I'd say, you know, a few years ago, probably maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I said, I'm just taking control of this. Every time the cell phone rings, I do not have to answer it. I just don't. So if I'm driving in my car and I think I need some peace just from everything so that I can just calm down or, you know, release some of the stress that's trying to come on me, then I don't answer the phone unless it's like usually you have caller ID or, you know, you can get the voicemail in a second, you know. I just decided I'm going to take control. And even on when people send me things, I get stacks of things to read. I've learned to just say to people, you know, I got your stack. And, you know, I have to admit to you, is there an executive summary in there? Because I probably only need to read the executive summary at this point. So I've tried to learn how to use my time so that I am using my time wisely. And with family, I really try to focus on, can I spend X amount of time with this member of my family? And I'm there in that moment. You know, I'm not a fan of taking calls in the car when other people are in my car. And when we're at dinner or lunch, I turn my cell phone off. As a consequence, though, I get people that call me back and go, I tried you for 5 times. Well, you know what? I was in a meeting, you know, and so I've decided that in order to really have quality time and quality conversations with people.
And sanity.
Absolutely. I just decided this is what it is. And I know that some people are going to shoot arrows at me. And I just decided, you know, they don't hurt me. Mm-hmm. What sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Mm-hmm. I can't allow that to pull me down. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been the biggest lesson for me, too, is recognizing that you are what you do and you are who you say you are and you're not who everybody else says you are. And so you have to make that commitment to yourself. And it's rough sometimes. I mean, being on the commission, you know, the other day I finally had a chance to listen to my voicemail actually driving up here. I had 22 messages and I had like 4 from the commission. Now, I had already instructed my assistant to call them and let them know I'd be late because I had an investor meeting that morning at 8:00. The commission meeting started at 9:00, but they wanted to start at 9:00. That's fine. But know that I won't be there probably until 10:30, 10:45, because my investor meeting was 8 to 10 and I had to be there. So I didn't even know because when I got in the car from that investor meeting, I decided I needed to decompress in order to be good for the next meeting. So I turned everything off, right? I even turned off my radio. So I'm just driving peacefully with the sunroof open, right? I get there in the meeting. I'm wondering why they're looking at me like, why are you just getting here? Well, it wasn't until last night. This is 3 days ago. It wasn't until last night. I'm driving up here. I had 4 messages from the commission secretary saying, hi, it's 9:20. We're just wondering where you are. It's 9:25. So what I realized is my assistant didn't connect to them and make it clear that I wouldn't be there till 10:30 or 10:45 because I literally arrived at 10:35. Mm-hmm. Had I had my phone on, I would have gotten those calls in that meeting. Or I would have gotten them in my car, which would have caused me a new level of stress because I would have tried to call them back and say, hey, I am coming. When in fact, I got there very rested. You know, I had some water And I went in and I was able to do my job. So I think, you know, you have to be ready for what that all entails. But I think it's so important for each of us to take control of our lives, take responsibility for the decisions that we make, and be willing to stand by them in order for us to proceed and be healthy and happy and humans that contribute to society in a good way.
Mm-hmm. Well, about contributing to society, what specific advice would you give to those interested in entering the nonprofit sector? I mean, what steps should they take, and what do you think they should be prepared to deal with?
Well, you know, and that's a really a great question because, you know, the nonprofit sector, in my experience, is like no other. And I've had just a small amount of my adult career in for-profit. So I have some level of comparison. And, you know, I think if you know you want to go into a nonprofit, I think it's important to volunteer in a nonprofit setting so you can really get a glimpse of what it's like. I volunteered in the political world and not realizing that's what I was doing to have any specific impact going forward. But I volunteered for almost 8 years in the political world, you know, and so I got a glimpse of, you know, if you're going to stuff envelopes, you're going to stuff the envelopes. The direct mail service is not going to stuff the envelopes for you, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, you've got to make phone calls. You're not going to have a dialing service do it. You've got to do it. So you've got to connect. And so I think volunteering, if you are really serious about it, will be helpful. And in almost any sector, because nonprofit sector tends to have the same challenges and outcomes, whether it's in the health industry or the education world or community development or, you know, depends. But largely, nonprofits have to raise money. They usually are working with less than they need. They can always tend to do more if they had more. And they're always looking to bring in new folks to help them do better and, mm-hmm. you know, do some sort of business processes, you know, overhauls, right? Mm-hmm. And I think so that's one thing. And I think, too, being prepared by knowing that it's not the corporate world. And we've had people come from the corporate world into our nonprofit world because they want to do something that's more fulfilling. They want to, mm-hmm. you know, share their experience and knowledge. And they come from sort of, and I'll use the banks as an example. They come from the banking world where to get one loan out, you may go through six departments. You know, you got to go through, you know, first is the frontliner, is the credit check, and then you get sent somewhere else through the analysis, and then you get somewhere else for the approval, and then you're sent somewhere else, and you have somebody different in each of these jobs. Well, you come to CFRC, and you got one person who does from, you know, soup to, you know, dessert on the loan. Mm-hmm. And so what we've learned is for-profit people that come into a nonprofit are a little freaked out by that. They're like, well, who's going to do that? You are. Mm-hmm. Well, who's going to go call the person? You are. You're going to mm-hmm. call the person, and you're going to sit down with them, and you're going to help them do TA. And, you know, you may have another person, but that's pretty well it. You know, mm-hmm. you don't have a whole department. So mm-hmm. it's rare, I think, in smaller nonprofits and even mid-sized nonprofits that you actually have every single thing done for you. You mm-hmm. tend to be an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm. And everyone wears lots of hats.
And including me. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started, I was wearing about 10 hats. I now wear probably 5, mm-hmm. you know. But I'm still wearing a lot of hats,
right.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you always think you're going to get there, but the demand doesn't seem to change. It doesn't seem to go down, mm-hmm. Especially when you're a mission-driven organization like Community Financial Resource Center is. But it tends to go up. And so every year, our demand increases. It doesn't decrease, and the funds seem to decrease, but, you know, we need them to increase. So there's a constant tension, if you will, between your ability to deliver services and your ability to have everything in place mm-hmm. on the financial and the fundraising side. So I think people need to be ready for that.
Okay.
But it's a fulfilling time, and you can still, and I offer this to people, too, mm-hmm. who can't really handle the whole nonprofit setting, you know, you can still work at your for-profit job and volunteer in a nonprofit. And often corporations will offer volunteer time. You know, they'll offer loaned execs and things like that. You can always donate. And I always think that people really should plan to donate to the nonprofit of their choice, because that's where differences are really made. And you're getting a group of people who are dedicated in a specific area that are doing things that you may not be willing to do. But, you know, our pastor has a thing where he says you need to either be a goer or a sender. You're either going to go and help, or you're going to send people by donating money so that they can go. So, you know, I think of people in that way. You got to be a goer or a sender. Either you're going to go and volunteer and you're going to go and help, or you're going to send some people by offering some money and sending a contribution to your favorite nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would imagine that the decision to get your MBA has influenced your career as a goer, and in that you've learned a lot about all of the different aspects of business, and you can wear those hats.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the best decisions I could have made was the MBA, of course, with my mother's pushing. But, you know, it has really done well for me. When I came out, I really went because I just wanted the knowledge. I knew that I wasn't going to necessarily get a promotion by going for an MBA. But I knew that I would get information that I would need in my career to help build a nonprofit, build a small business. And so, honestly, it has really help me to think strategically, to have clarity around issues. And I really believe it's one of the reasons that I'm often asked to serve on boards, because they know I have not only the practical side, but the formal education side. Mm-hmm. And so those two things, I think, in combination have really made me more marketable, not necessarily in the for-profit, but certainly in the nonprofit and public sector side.
And Faresi, for our last question, thank you so much for your time. I was wondering if you had any parting advice to give to current and recently graduated MBA students. What did you wish you knew then as a new graduate?
Well, you know, it's funny because as I think back about that, I thought I knew everything. So when you come out of MBA school, you think you know it all, especially when you come out of Pepperdine, you know. So I was a really enthusiastic wave who thought that I knew everything. And I just want to encourage people to recognize you think you know, you really don't, and to be prepared to learn some more. You know, I spend every day looking at the end of the day at what I learned again today. And you know, I used to think that was an old cliche that people just said that. And now I find myself doing it. What did I learn today? Whether I'm just sitting in an airport, or I'm driving in my car, or I'm looking at a tree and a bird flies into it or away from it, I'm learning something all the time, whether I read it or... So I just encourage people to stay open and know that, yes, while you know everything, quote unquote, there's so much more to learn on the practical side, and be prepared and open to receive that, because it's just going to make you a better person.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I've really appreciated talking to you. You've definitely given a lot of food for thought, so thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this, and I appreciate the honor of being with you in this interview. Thank you.